Hi there, and welcome to episode 32 of the Smart English Coach podcast, the podcast that helps you to get to advanced English level fast. So this podcast episode is for you if you are interested in taking an English exam. With me on the podcast is Craig from inglespodcast.com. Craig is a Cambridge speaking examiner for all five levels of the Cambridge exams, and he's taught the B2 first exam for a very long time. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you, Claire. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to be talking about exams, which isn't a sentence we hear very often, is it?
Absolutely not. Most people hate taking exams, but they can be useful. So, Craig, what are some of the advantages of taking exams?
Well, possibly the first thing that comes to mind is career advancement, because these days many employers are looking for English qualifications if English is not your first language. So it's really good to have an English qualification on your CV, on your resume. Now, in Spain, where I teach, for example, in my experience teaching at the British Council, I had many students who worked in the public school system. They were teachers in the schools here, in the state schools, and they needed a minimum Cambridge B2 first level in order to work in the public school system. So that's one example. Another example, of course, for university study, because many students go to study abroad and many universities want to see your level in an IELTS test, for example, or a TOEFL test. And these are language tests to see what band you're in, what group you're in as a proficient language speaker. But basically, it just, if you're career-minded, if you want to advance, it's a really good idea to have an exam qualification in English on your CV.
Yeah, I really get that. Certainly in Italy, if you wanted to do a master's degree, they wanted to see that you had the B2 first before letting you onto the course.
Yes, exactly. Now, I know they're expensive in money and in time because you have to prepare and study for them, but they are an investment in your future. And one thing to note is that the Cambridge exams, they don't have an expiry date. So if you do pass B2 first or C1 advanced, then you have that level really for perpetuity. They don't say, oh, it's only last for 5 years and then you have to retake the exam. So at the moment, it is something that will stay with you during your working life.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I think the TOEFL has a shelf life of just 2 years, is that right?
Yes, I believe so. I think so, yes. So you're limited with those TOEFL, and I think IELTS has a shelf life as well, an expiry date on it.
So what other reasons should people think about taking the exam then, Craig?
Well, even if you're not, if you don't particularly need it for your career, if you're not thinking, oh, I need this qualification, exams do give you something to aim for. So they provide a plan of study. Now, I know students who take exams that they don't really need. They don't necessarily need the qualification, but it gives them a goal, something to aim for. And an exam provides that because we all learn differently. Some people have no problem organizing their studies themselves. I'm not one of those people. I need a plan of study in order to reach a certain goal or level. So that's where exams can come in. So my suggestion to you is ask what kind of student you are. Even if you don't need an English qualification at the moment, can you effectively organize your studies by yourself? And if not, maybe consider taking an exam course. And my third point, Claire, is it improves all four skills at the same time, because maybe you're focusing independently too much on listening or reading, whereas if you're studying for an exam, they tend to cover all the four skills: writing, speaking, listening, and what's the other one?
Reading.
Thank you. Reading. So, yeah, I mean, you learn formal writing, essays, reports, reading skills. We're kind of losing them at the moment with internet and messaging and things like that. So it's really good to do extensive reading and learn how to speed read and read for specific information. And you learn those skills when you study for an exam.
I have to say that even as a native English speaker, I find some of these reading skills really tough.
Yes, they are. And some of the writing skills too. I mean, when was the last time you wrote a formal, very formal email or letter to anybody and put it in the post? It's been a long time for me, because even business emails these days, in my opinion, they're not especially formal. Are they really? Not the way that Cambridge tend to teach people to write. So I don't think they're really real world tasks, but they do teach you formal writing, which can come in useful in the future.
And the other thing, of course, they do is they turn you into a grammar expert with, for example, some of those transformational exercises that you have to do.
Yes, definitely. And it's good to think about the way you can manipulate and use grammar in different imaginative ways, because that will make your English more flexible.
So this kind of leads me on to the next question, which is, what areas of the B2 first exam cause most problems in your opinion?
That's not an easy question to answer, Claire. Thinking of my own experience, for example, I've taught students who loved to play games on the internet, gamers. Now, gamers on the internet who are connecting with English speakers all over the world, they tend to have excellent listening and speaking skills because they're speaking and listening while they're playing video games. However, some students might be avid readers. They read a lot. They read constantly in their language and in English. So they tend to have no problems really with the reading comprehension part of the exam. And then there might be another student who spent a long time abroad studying, 3 or 4 years on summer courses, for example. So they tend to be very good with listening and speaking. So all language learners have their particular strengths and weaknesses. It's a very general thing. But if I had to generalize about Spanish students, the students that I've taught, probably writing and grammar that tends to cause some problems. We don't write the way, as I said before, that we used to. We tend to write with abbreviations on the internet. We use emoticons now. So people aren't used to writing long form. Although my Spanish students tend to be very nervous about speaking. Although in my experience, that's possibly the easiest part of the test. Is that your experience with Italian students?
Absolutely. I'm right with you on that one. When I was preparing Italian students for, again, most levels of the Cambridge exams, they were generally terrified about the speaking part. And I would always say to them, look, I have never had a student fail on the speaking. The other parts of the exam, in my opinion, are a lot more difficult because the speaking is short and you're with somebody else. And even if you're really nervous, you've always got that other person with you. And I think that can sort of make the experience a little bit easier. I think Italian students can often fall down on the writing, often because the paragraphing rules in Italian seem to be different from paragraph rules in English. I think the grammar can also be quite tricky, and then the listening is often quite hard.
Yeah, I agree. Spanish students are very similar in that respect. But I think whatever your nationality is, it's a good idea to find your common mistakes and work on correcting them, because that will help you in the grammar and in the writing. For example, a Spanish student might directly translate something like, I have 25 years, which if you translate that directly from Spanish to English, that's what it is. Although we say, I'm 25 or I'm 25 years old. Or they might say, let me give you an advice, because advice is countable in Spanish. So if you can focus on the problems you're having when you're translating into English, I think that will help you a lot with your grammar, in the grammar part of the exam, and with your writing.
Yeah, and I always used to say to my students, try and work out what they're asking you for in the grammar part. Are they testing you on the passive forms? Are they testing you on reported speech? Are they testing you on a conditional, for example? If you can recognize the grammar area that they want to see, then it often helps you to produce the right form.
Yes, exactly. That's a good tip.
So we've talked a little bit about the B2, the first exam, which bring students up to a sort of upper intermediate level. And of course, the level afterwards, after that, is the C1, the advanced exam. And how long do you think students should wait between these two exams?
That's another question I'm going to have to give you an answer of. It depends, Claire. I know it's frustrating not to give a clear answer, but it really does depend on the time available to the student and the way they organise their studies and their ability in different skills, in different areas. But in my experience at the British Council, they had 2 years of study between B2 and C1, and only 1 year of study between C1 and C2, which is proficiency, which means that in their opinion, it's interesting, isn't it? In their opinion, going from B2 to C1 is twice as long as going from advanced to proficiency. Now, when I say a year of study, that's typically studying twice a week, two lessons a week, maybe 3 or 4 hours a week during an academic year, with a long break in the summer and a break for Christmas and Easter, etc. So obviously, if you have a lot of time on your hands and you're studying very intensively, then it's a lot less time. And if you're living and studying in an English-speaking country, then even less. So it depends on your situation, how much time you have to dedicate to your studies, how busy you are. Do you have a family? Are you very busy at work? So it's a very difficult thing to pin down as far as time is concerned.
Yeah, these factors are really important. And also, what sort of study are you doing? So if you're only coming to lessons and not doing anything in between, this time isn't, say, as intensive as going to the lessons, then doing extra homework, then maybe taking lots of opportunities to use the language. There are different types of studies, aren't
exactly.
there?
Exactly. And one thing I would recommend is to every couple of months, if you are studying every 2 or 3 months, go to the Cambridge exam website and do a past paper to see where your level is. Because if you're hitting or scoring more than 60%, then you're doing very, very well and possibly ready to do a preparation course for technique and strategy to take the exam. So that's a good barometer, if you like. It's a good way to test to see how your level is advancing, to do these past paper tests that you can find on the internet and on the Cambridge website.
So as you said, at the British Council, they advised 2 years of studying to get ready for the advanced exam. What sort of things can people do to perhaps make it quicker to get there, or to overcome the sort of the language gaps that there might be between these two levels?
Well, the thing that really separates the difference between a B2 level from a C1 level, the short answer is the depth and the breadth of the language. So how deep your language knowledge goes and how wide it is in respect of collocations, vocabulary, phrasal verbs, expressions, etc. That's the short answer. The long answer, I would send students to look at the CEFR website, which is the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages, long name, which is kind of like, it's like a guide. It has different bands and different groups according to levels. And the way that they define the B2 level is an independent user of English. So you don't need Google Translate, you don't need a dictionary, you can manage in most situations by using your English at an upper intermediate level. And C1 is defined as a proficient user. So I don't think that's particularly helpful. To be a little bit more, let me paraphrase what they're saying there. So if you are a C1 level, advanced, then you're using more complex, complicated grammar. You're using more advanced vocabulary and collocations. And you're dealing with, which means writing and reading, more complex, longer texts than you would be at B2. And when you're speaking, you're more fluent. You're more spontaneous. You don't need as much time to speak. There's less hesitation. And you're able to connect your ideas when you're speaking and organize your thoughts more effectively. So to quote something on their website, they say, This student can use language flexibly and effectively for social, academic, and professional purposes. There is a step up from B2 to C1 with maybe more sophisticated, more advanced language across all the four skills.
You can basically operate effectively in most situations.
Exactly. I had a student a few years ago who worked in IT. He was a young guy here in Valencia, and he wanted to work for Google. That was his big ambition. So he studied for B2 first, and he passed. And I saw him a few months after he finished my course, and I chatted to him and said, how are you doing with applying to work for Google? He said, oh, they've changed their requirements. They're now asking as a minimum for C1 Advanced. Some companies require a more sophisticated language. We're connecting more with different nationalities via Zoom on the internet, and they need employees to have that higher level of sophistication with their English.
I recently prepared someone for the C1 Advanced, and we were looking at some of the reading questions together. To be honest, I found those questions quite difficult. And in many cases, it wasn't obvious what the answer was. And then in the listening as well, you know, my student was complaining that, you know, you have to do so much in such a short period of time. It's not only listening for understanding the conversation. You then have to work out some synonyms or some antonyms. You have to work out the intention of the speaker. So these are really quite sophisticated skills, and you don't have very much time to process that language. And I find that tricky as well. And English is my first language. So we're asking students to do quite a lot, aren't we, at C1 level?
Yeah, the students need to expose themselves as much as possible to English. The more they listen, the more they read, then the better their skills will be at dealing with that. But you're right, from C1 and C2, the exams are not easy. And sometimes I need to think as a native speaker as well when I'm doing those tests with students. It's difficult, but practice will get you there. The more you practice, the better you will become.
We're kind of in danger of sort of putting people off the exam by saying, oh, it's really, really hard. But the one thing I do want to emphasize is that it is a fantastic achievement to get to C1. And when you are there, you can do so much more with your English. You know, you, as you said before, you are a proficient user. Reading anything in English will take you less time. Watching a film or TV show, you know, you're understanding, you know, possibly 80% and more. So there's a huge amount of satisfaction, whether that's professional satisfaction for getting that job at Google or just personal satisfaction that you can do things in English much more easily. You obviously have a real rich knowledge of English, and that in itself is, I would say, a great motivation to actually take and pass the C1.
Absolutely. And I think people need these goals. They need to set different goals and achieve them and work towards something. And it's very, very satisfying when you reach those goals and you can sit back and say, yes, I've got this qualification now. I feel more comfortable with my English. And as you mentioned about the tasks in the exam, they are real life tasks. You have to have a telephone conversation or a Zoom call with people, clients in the workspace. You need to understand what people are saying during meetings that are in English.
You talked a lot about motivation and having goals, that journey to reaching those goals. So my final question is about language learning and goals. And what do you think holds students back from getting to their goals?
Well, take me, for example, Claire. I'm the classic example of apathy when it comes to my Spanish goals because I've been living here in Spain for many, many years. And although in most situations, and this takes us back to those language reference levels I spoke about earlier, when I go shopping, when I speak with people socially, I'm okay with my Spanish. But there are some things that I really need to push myself to be able to do. For example, to speak at length about abstract topics, or to tell a story in the past with correct tenses, or to read a complicated text. those things are difficult for me. So I think that can hold students back. They get to a language learning plateau and a certain level, they think, oh, well, I'm okay, I've got my B2, I can speak to people in English, and they're not particularly happy with their language skills, but they don't push themselves to get to that next level. And I think for me personally, it's a question of extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. Because if you need an exam for your job, that's extrinsic. Your employer is telling you, you must have this, and you study and you pass. So that's kind of what I did when I first needed to function in Spanish. But when I started living here, and my wife's Spanish, and she helps me write emails sometimes, I don't really have the intrinsic motivation, the why, the big why, to get to the next level. So if you can find that as a student, and you can get that internal motivation to get to the next level, that will push you there to those advanced and proficiency levels.
And I think obviously intrinsic motivation is always more powerful than extrinsic motivation. You need, as you said, your why to reaching your goals.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you need to cultivate your curiosity. You need to tap into your hobbies, your interests, or your profession. And you need to find a hook that gives you a reason to search English on the internet, whether it be video, audio podcasts, or reading or blogs around your chosen topics. And I think exposing yourself to English around things that you're passionate about and interested in, that will help to push you forward.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. And just the final thing then, Craig, you have a course, don't you, to help students pass the B2 first exam. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, it's basically what I used to do when I worked for the British Council for 24 years, which is a horribly long time. But I taught many B2 first students and helped them pass the exam. And when I left the BC, I created a video course to help them prepare and get ready to take the exam. So you need to have the level first. This won't get you to B2 first level, but it will teach you the strategies and the techniques you need to do the exam well and get the best mark possible. Now, there's a free level test on the website. Go to englishmasterclass.net. And Claire, maybe you'll be kind enough to put that link in the show notes. And sign up for a free level test. Take your test. If you score 60% or more, then you are probably ready to take the course. So I'll have your email. I will contact you with more details. And if you listen to this podcast before the end of 2022, the price will be the same. So the price is increasing next year. At the moment, it's €187, and that includes all of the videos, the support material in PDF, a practice speaking test with me on Zoom, and I will check 4 of your writings and give you feedback on those. So all of that's included in the course. And if you're interested, get in touch.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. So to reiterate, you get a speaking practice exam with you and 4 writings corrected as well.
Yes, with feedback. And of course, I'll be available via email if you have any particular questions while you're doing the course. But apart from the writings and the speaking practice, it's basically self-study. So you watch the videos, you do the practice tests in PDF, and you do it at your own pace in your own time.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And as you said, before the end of 2022, the price remains the same.
Yes, that's correct. It's going to go up just a little bit from January 2023.
Thank you so much, Craig, for coming onto the podcast. And thank you so much for sharing all your experience with the B2 and also the C1. I'm sure this is going to be really, really helpful for everyone listening. So thank you very much again.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Claire.